Hi, I'm Chris, and welcome to Foundations in Social Innovation. If you think about it, all social impact work aims in some way to contribute to improvements in human well-being. But what is well-being, and how do we get to it? Those are questions that have occupied philosophers since antiquity, and in recent times it's been tackled by health professionals, evaluators, people working in international development, and surprisingly perhaps, economists. Because it turns out that structuring programs, policies, and societies around well-being provides a fundamental challenge to the status quo of most industrialized societies. This podcast is being recorded on unceded Kaurna land, and I'd like to pay my respects to elders past, present, and future, and to recognise the traditional custodians of the lands on which you're listening today.
So my name's Clinton Schultz. I'm a psychologist who happens to be Aboriginal. I'm a Gamilaroi man, so my mob are from northwest New South Wales. My mob are actually from a place that these days is called Lake Keepit, sort of just outside Gunnedah. I've spent most of my life on the Gold Coast, though, and in North Brisbane. So that's the short version. I'll leave it there, because usually I'll talk about myself half the day. Okay, so what I've come along to talk to is this model of social-emotional well-being that quite a few of us members of AIPA have been working on for quite a while now, and it's been evolving constantly for several years now until it's got to this. And to get to here, as Pat said, the groundwork was all done starting back in 1989 with the National Aboriginal Health Strategy, and then 1995 with the Ways Forward Report, and then the social-emotional wellbeing framework that was in place 2004-2009, which is being worked on renewed presently. So that's a lot of the background information that's led to this.
This is Clinton Schultz, Indigenous Allied Health Professional of the Year in 2019, and he's speaking at a conference of allied health professionals. And what he's about to share is a framework for Aboriginal social and emotional well-being that he developed alongside a number of his colleagues. It's a framework that's currently in use by the Australian government to provide some parameters for thinking about what well-being might mean to Aboriginal people.
So the best way for you guys to wrap your heads around this thing is to think of it like a wheel, laid out exactly like the wheel on your car. So at the centre there, you've got your hub or your nuts that hold everything stable. Everything's held together by that there. So you can put whatever word you want in there. We've put holistic social-emotional well-being just to help people not confuse it with other uses of social-emotional well-being that are around. And then if you think of these domains that are sort of sitting out here, think of those like the spokes on your wheel. So those spokes obviously help to keep the hub and everything strong and keep that nut and everything in place. So those spokes are all part of this one great model. So here you can see we've got connection to physical well-being. So the way this is structured is we've started with the individual. So looking at those aspects that are related to individual experience, individual well-being, and then we sort of work out from there and start taking into consideration those elements of family and community and culture, et cetera, until we get out to country. So connection to physical well-being. As an Aboriginal man, as a Gamilaroi man, when I think of physical well-being, yes, I'm considering all those elements of physical health and well-being that we'd usually consider: nutrition, healthy lifestyle, you know, not being exposed to chronic disease, etc., etc. All those elements. But also when I'm thinking about physical well-being from an Aboriginal perspective, I'm thinking of it as the body is a vessel. So that connection of body to spirit is also very important. So connection to mental and emotional well-being. I'll give you an example of physical well-being, what I'm talking about there. So I surf a lot, I engage in a lot of sport. I also ride a motorbike. I'm gonna touch a table with something wood here before I keep going. I could at some stage have a motorbike accident, which could lead to me losing my leg, for instance, which would mean I would not be able to continue with the everyday activities that I enjoy doing in my life that help form my identity as that person. So that's also what and a part of physical well-being to us, which starts to reach into that mental and emotional. So starts to obviously connect with that mental and emotional side also. So beyond all the psychological and emotional factors that we generally think of in terms of mental and emotional well-being, once again, as a Gamilaroi man, when I'm talking about connection to my emotional or my mental state, I'm talking about my ability to just sit and be at peace with my thoughts. So if I'm at unease at any stage, there'll be certain places that I can go where I can just sit and I can listen to what's going on around me. It might be my ancestors talking to me, it might be the birds, it could just be the trees. I can process all that information. Now, if I was to lose that ability, that would lead to quite a lot of instability for me, because it's an important part of who I am and of my identity. So we need to start thinking, I guess, outside of those usual elements of biological or physiological health that we generally consider, because for people, all peoples of ethnically diverse or culturally diverse backgrounds, and particularly Aboriginal people, there's other issues, there's other areas that are of great importance to us. So connection to family and kinship. So when we're yarning about family, it's a much grander concept than I guess many people are used to in an individualistic society. So Australia recently was voted as the second most individualistic society on the planet, just behind the US. They only just pipped us. But when you're talking about Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples, you've got some of the most collectivist societies that you'll come across globally. So polar differences there. So when we're talking about family, we're not talking just about that nuclear unit. We're talking about family that's been established through processes of removal and people having to establish new families. We're talking about family through processes of kinship and law and the constructions that go around those. We're talking about families based around concepts of respect and endearment. So anybody I hold great respect for is just as much my family as my direct brother or sister are. So we've got a lot more connections with a lot more people a lot of the time. Connection to community. So when we're considering community, once again, it's one of these terms that can have many different meanings when you're talking to Aboriginal people. So I could be talking about my geographic community. So I'm a member of the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander community on the Gold Coast, because that's where I live. I could be talking about my heritage community. So I'm a Gamilaroi man, so I could be talking about that community. I could be using it in a generalised term to talk when I'm talking about engaging with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. So I might just be saying, yeah, I've got to go have a yarn to community. What I'm actually saying is I've just got to go have a yarn with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. So there's many different ways that that word community will also be utilised or people will understand. And each is just as valid and each is just as important. It's not up to us to establish what these definitions should be. It's up to each individual to construct these ideals for themselves. So culture, generally when we're talking about culture, people consider things like language. Language is obviously the most important part of most people's culture. But also law for us, so L-O-R-E. Everybody would have heard L-O-R-E, law, Aboriginal concept of law, which is vastly different to L-A-W. Our law is based on ancient principles of respect and understanding, and it's been unchanged since the beginning of time, so everybody's aware of what it is, whereas LAW seems to change every couple of days and nobody can ever keep up with new legislations. So it can be very confusing for people. But it also includes our song, our dance, our arts and all that sort of stuff, all those elements that make us Aboriginal peoples. And connection to land or connection to country. You'll also hear people use the words connection to nature or connection to environment in there, particularly people who unfortunately have been removed and haven't had the opportunity or the chance to get back to country, to meet their mob or to engage with their peoples. So that you'll find a lot of people will still have this inherent, very strong connection to nature or to the environment. So people might just like being at the beach. They don't really know why, they've just always felt safe at the beach. For some people that I engage with, it's their garden. They just feel comfortable and safe in their garden. That's the exact same connection to country as I experience as a Gamilaroi man when I've got my feet rubbing in the dirt around Lake Keepit. It's the exact same thing. We can't minimalise the experiences that people have around country, connection to country, because unfortunately not everybody has had the opportunity to feel that experience of connection to country, and they've had to forge new ways of instilling some of that connection for themselves. And then connection to spirituality and ancestors, and this is a section that sometimes raises some concerns for people, because they go, oh, spirituality. So when people try and label what spirituality should be sometimes, for me and for many other peoples who work in this area, spirituality is just a set of beliefs and a set of principles that people are guided by and believe in. It doesn't matter if it's, you know, our beliefs in the dreaming or people's beliefs in the Bible and Christianity or even people's steadfast belief in science. It's a set of beliefs, it's a set of principles, it's a set of them, of ways they understand themselves in the environments that they're in. And they're all just as valid as each other. So for instance, if I went somewhere like Yarrabah and I polled people up there, what spirituality do you, I'd be likely to get everything back from a strong connection to country or a strong connection to my dreaming to a strong connection with Christ and with my religion. And each one is exactly, or is just as strongly valid as each other. And it's not up to us to determine what spirituality is for individuals. So I guess one of the real strengths of this model is that it is inclusive. We're not trying to look for, I guess, we're not trying to put variance aside. We're trying to be welcoming of that variance and establish that everybody has got some levels of this variance within them.
And this is one of the real challenges when it comes to thinking about well-being, particularly when you're working at scale. Well-being is clearly cultural, it's clearly intensely personal. But how do you work with that variance and how do you measure it? How do you design something that works for everybody?
So you're going to have these variances across everybody. And obviously across Australia, we're no homogenous Aboriginal people. We're a makeup of many, 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 many individual nations. So this is also going to vary across every single one of those nations you go to. I'd argue it'll also vary in every single community within those nations and amongst every individual within those communities. But that's okay. That's the greatness of this, is that it allows for that.
For another perspective on well-being, let's turn to the economists. And the French. Well, sort of the French. In 2008, French President Nicolas Sarkozy wanted to find a better indicator for social progress in his country. So to do that, he called together three of the big thinkers at the time in this kind of work. Joseph Stiglitz, professor from Columbia University in the US. Professor Amartya Sen, from the Indian development economist and philosopher. And we'll hear more from Sen later, more on his philosophy. And also French professor Fitoussi. The work they did together led to the development of the UN Human Development Index, which is still used today to compare the relative progress of nations on a diverse range of indicators. The report found that well-being is hard to measure and easy to mismeasure, and that subjective measures and objective measures are both important. It also gave us a general overview of the dimensions of well-being in their view. And we can compare that with Clinton's Aboriginal and Social and Emotional Wellbeing Framework. So I'm quoting the report here. Whilst the precise list of the features affecting quality of life inevitably rest on value judgments, there is a consensus that quality of life depends on people's health and education, their everyday activities, which include the right to a decent job and housing, their participation in the political process, the social and natural environment in which they live, and the factors shaping their personal and economic security. Measuring all these features requires both objective and subjective data. I think you can see some overlaps there with the Aboriginal Social and Emotional Wellbeing Framework, but also some additions and some differences. This framework includes the environment, it includes social connections and relationships, and also political voice and governance. This framework and the Aboriginal Social and Emotional Wellbeing Framework are just two of the many, many examples of multidimensional wellbeing frameworks.
on traditional measures, budget surpluses, people would look at us and go, you're doing okay. But we have homelessness at staggering rates, one of the highest rates of youth suicide in the OECD. Our mental health and wellbeing is not what it should be. So our plan is through the wellbeing work that we're doing, a living standards framework, and our wellbeing budget, where if you're a minister, you want to spend money, you have to prove that you are going to improve intergenerational wellbeing. We are hoping to embed in actually what the public is asking us for, to address the societal wellbeing of our nation, not just our economic wellbeing.
In 2019, Jacinda Ardern announced New Zealand's wellbeing budget, which actually builds on many of the ideas put in that 2008 paper for Sarkozy, even though she's of the completely different political persuasion. New Zealand's wellbeing budget is recognised as a policy innovation in and of itself because it restructures measures of success and the policy-making process around wellbeing. And mostly, governments don't do that. In his introduction to the budget, Grant Robinson, who's the finance minister behind the budget, said this: "The approach represents a significant departure from the status quo. Budgets have traditionally focused on a limited set of economic data. Success has been declared on the basis of a narrow range of indicators, like GDP growth. But New Zealanders have questioned that claim of success when they've seen other things that we hold dear. Child well-being, a warm, dry home, or being able to swim in our rivers and lakes, getting steadily worse. The old ways have left too many people behind. It is time to change. New Zealanders want us to measure our success in line with their values, the importance of fairness, the protection of the environment, the strength of our communities. That is what the wellbeing budget sets out to do. Many countries around the world have begun to look at different ways of measuring success to better reflect the well-being of their people. This budget goes further and puts well-being at the heart of everything we do. To set the priorities for this budget, we used evidence and expert advice to tell us where we could make the greatest difference to the well-being of New Zealanders. Each bid for funding required a well-being analysis to make sure that funding would address those priorities. We've broken down the silos of government to support programs that bring together agencies to solve the big challenges of our time." Jacinda and Grant's focus was on a wellbeing budget across all of government. Grant talks about how it challenges the status quo, and that's true even within the explicitly social departments of government, such as health and education. For example, we've worked with education departments that focus on student achievement whilst neglecting student wellbeing. We've worked with health departments who focus on clinical outcomes over and above the well-being of patients, their carers, and families. For the most part in Australia, services are not funded to create outcomes or well-being. And if you do create an innovation, a social innovation, that is better at creating well-being than the alternatives, there isn't necessarily a system to identify that, to fund that, to make it part of the mainstream. You could say that the very intent of social innovation is at odds with the status quo of much of our social systems. Certainly in Australia. Perhaps less so in New Zealand, but the long-term effects of the wellbeing budget remain to be seen. We've seen how one culture's view of wellbeing is not necessarily another's. So there's a real danger that social innovation work preferences well-being as defined by the dominant culture. I think social innovation projects need to find a way to bridge between multiple alternate models of well-being. And the Interplay Well-being Framework is a fascinating project that does just that. It's shown how taking a primary focus on building well-being for Aboriginal people, as self-defined by Aboriginal people, for example, speaking Aboriginal language, leads to the kinds of outcomes that are prioritised by government, for example, literacy in English. This is Sherry Kearney talking about the model and her research.
Over a decade ago, Aboriginal groups in Central Australia started their own grassroots desert knowledge movement. So I joined this collaboration 4 years ago and now lead a national study on Aboriginal wellbeing in remote communities. We spent several years going to different communities around Australia to ask about their values and goals in life and work out how these can be measured in order to show their importance to government. The way we thought about it was that Aboriginal knowledge is passed down through stories, and governments mainly speak the language of numbers. So we could bring together stories and numbers for the two worlds to meet. Now, Aboriginal culture in Australia isn't just one culture, it's many, but there were some clear similarities. All those we spoke to voiced the same three priorities: culture, empowerment, and community. People wanted to be empowered to practice their own culture in a society that enabled them to do so. They want the freedom to be themselves. But the difference between these people and myself is that they live in a broader society that does not reflect their cultural values, and in fact measures them up against things that don't reflect their own views of success. So we unpacked Aboriginal stories to create new definitions and measures of success. And our work is showing statistically that these factors are the key foundations of wellbeing for Aboriginal people. Not only that, we're discovering the importance of working together and learning from each other. One hand can't clap without the other. We're bringing together the core priorities for both government, being education, employment and health, and Aboriginal people, being culture, empowerment and community, in what we call the Interplay Wellbeing Framework. With interplay meaning that everything hangs together, everything exists together. Education doesn't exist without culture, health doesn't exist without community, employment can't be sustained without empowerment. They're all interrelated, they all interplay. But we have to prove it. And it has to speak a language that both communities and governments understand. When we looked at our data, we found that it supported what communities said. It showed that culture, empowerment, and community are in fact stepping stones to achieve success in education, employment, and health. Let's look at education, for example. Now, language is key in remote communities. Many languages have been lost, but many are very much alive. Some Aboriginal people speak 4 or 5 different languages as well as English. But Aboriginal language speakers have very little chance to learn their own language at school. Our analysis showed that Aboriginal students who learn about their own culture at school and first learn literacy in their own language, so Aboriginal literacy, do better at English literacy and numeracy. That is, education outcomes are better for those who learn Aboriginal literacy as a stepping stone to English literacy. Like most things in life, students need to walk before they can run. Now, this may not seem like rocket science, but while we continue to measure failure instead of what creates success, not only do we perpetuate the failure, but we miss a fundamental opportunity to learn from and preserve the oldest surviving culture in the world. Culture is identity. So being asked to drop your culture is like being asked to drop who you are. Practicing culture at school and work appear to be key components of wellbeing. So let's look at the workplace. Māori people's traditional lands cover most of West Australia's inland deserts. Some Māori people alive today had their first contact with white people and the modern world in their lifetime. Being moved from their ancestral lands a generation or two ago for mining and farming led many Māori to alcoholism and violence. But in the last 15 years, things are changing. The mines have begun to work together with Māori people. They started tapping into the deep knowledge that Māori have of the land and employed Māori in land management roles known as rangers. Jobs became flexible, so Māori no longer had to choose between their job and participating in cultural ceremonies. They can do both. So the Māori feel proud to share their knowledge in their work, and the mines now have stable long-term Māori employees. So ranger programs have been successful elsewhere. There's around 800 Aboriginal rangers now employed across Australia. So the ranger and the Aboriginal art industry are examples of culture-based economies, where people can work and participate in the economy through practicing culture. But not everybody can be or wants to be a ranger or an artist. And many Aboriginal people have been separated from their lands and language. So the point is this: education and work that enables you to operate from the safety and strength of your own culture enables you to be true to who you are, which appears to be a key element of wellbeing. By valuing what's most important to people in a language that governments understand, being numbers, enables governments to work out where they can best invest to create change. This means that governments can achieve their goals by empowering Aboriginal people to build from their own cultural strengths. Everybody's happy. And it means involving Aboriginal people in their own solutions. We don't have to stick to narrow measures of success based on our own view of the world. By acknowledging what's important to unique communities, not only do we validate and empower them, but we also grant ourselves the opportunity to learn from them. This is my good friend, Yolngu leader Trevor Guruwiwi from Elko Island in Arnhem Land. Just last month, I asked him, what's the one thing governments could do to improve wellbeing for Aboriginal people? He said this.
Walk with us to share those knowledge from those two world views.
Thank you.
Suddenly at 5 o'clock or 5:15 in the morning, the telephone rang. My first thought was that something terribly tragic must have happened. Somebody has turned ill or you know, something worse than that. So I was concerned. So I was, the first bit of relief was that it wasn't any of that. And then when I examined the news, the news seemed good because this was the Academy calling. And in fact, the chairman of the Nobel Committee, as well as another member, spoke with me along with the secretary of the Academy. And so the news sank in that it was a good piece of news, even though it's early hours in the morning, I needed a cup of coffee.
That was Professor Marcia Sen speaking in 1988 about the phone call he got from the Nobel Prize Committee telling him he'd just won. When it comes to talking about well-being, Sen is a key figure. You may remember he was an advisor to the Sarkozy Commission report. But here we're going to dig into his philosophy with the help of a couple of academics who understand his work much better than I do. First of all, we're going to hear from Professor Alex Tabarrok from the University of Virginia.
Amartya Sen is an Indian and Bengali economist born in 1933 and winner of a Nobel Prize in economics. When Sen was appointed to Harvard University, he received a professorship not only in the economics department, but also in the philosophy department. So we're going to start with Sen on philosophy. Development economists or policy advisors often find themselves in the position of having to address, you know, what really is a good outcome anyway? The typical standard of economics is to identify a good outcome with greater wealth or higher GDP. But Sen made the point that a country can be wealthy, but perhaps not everyone in that country is very happy, or maybe people don't live very long, or maybe they have lives which are by some standard impoverished or lacking. So Sen has been a consistent critic of using wealth or GDP as a metric for a good outcome. A second common standard is to ask, how happy are the people in a given country or region? But Sen makes the point that happiness is an extremely subjective thing to judge. It's very hard to say who is happy and who is not.
So for a time in the 2010s, it became very fashionable to look at measuring national happiness. But we've got to be really careful when we're asking people to self-report on their own subjective well-being. Or rather, when we're taking that subjective measure as the only measure. So to explore this theme a little bit further, we're going to jump into another lecture, this time from Sabina Alkery, who's director at the Oxford Poverty Human Development Initiative at the University of Oxford.
Sen, in his 2002 BMJ article, gives the example of people in widows in Kerala, a wealthy state in India, which has low morbidity and long life expectancy, and widows in Bihar, a poorer state which has high morbidity and low life expectancy. And the people in Bihar said, yeah, they're quite satisfied with their health. And the people in Kerala said, no, it's terrible. But their life expectancies were longer and their morbidity was lower. And so you had the opposite relationship between self-reported health and objective functionings indicators. This is very, very commonly known in the case of fear of violence, where those with the least probability of being victims are the most afraid. Carol Graham, in her recent book, Miserable Millionaires and Happy Peasants or something, also documents that the self-reported health of people in Kenya is equal to the self-reported health of Americans. So self-reported health, particularly in contexts where their lower education or the frame of reference, again, exhibits adaptation, may not be an adequate objective proxy for health functionings. It has to be tested.
Let's head back over to Professor Alex's lecture. And you may remember that he's talking about the limitations of conventional measures of well-being.
Finally, some philosophers, some observers suggest what is called a basic needs standard for a developing economy. Look at a region and ask, do people in that place have their basic needs satisfied? But which exactly needs are basic and which are not basic? Sen has stressed the point that the basic needs standard, it's about what you send people, and it's not really about what they can do with what they've been sent. So for all these reasons, Sen has rejected wealth, happiness, and basic needs as the best standards for a good outcome. What then? Sen suggests the notion of capabilities. Capabilities as a positive option, which are the choices that people have which they are free to realize. What are the things they can do? What is within their grasp? What kind of lives do they have? What kind of possible achievements can they choose from? This is Sen's notion of what is a good outcome. When one outcome offers better capabilities to the citizens of a region than another, we can judge that to be the better outcome. For Sen, capabilities is an absolute concept, not a relative concept. It doesn't depend upon comparing the options of one person to another. And the notion of capabilities for Sen, it also respects human diversity. That is, it notes that simply sending people resources doesn't make their lives good. The question is, what can people do with those resources? So Sen at one point makes the example of a bicycle. If you send a bicycle to a person who is disabled, you haven't actually improved that person's capabilities very much if the disabled person does not have the capacity to ride the bicycle. What does it mean on a concrete level? Well, people disagree. But one thing is for sure, Sen developed these ideas in the 1980s, and they have had a big impact on the United Nations Human Development Index. The Human Development Index doesn't only look at wealth, but it looks at life expectancy, adult literacy, and school enrollment in judging how good an outcome is, in judging how developed a country is. Sen himself stresses that he does not have a particular or exact list in mind for the relevant capabilities. From Sen's point of view, it's really something that an individual country or region needs to choose using a democratic process. But other people who have been influenced by Sen, they have talked quite a bit about what the capabilities should be. Some philosophers have suggested health, play, imagination, gender equality, autonomy, freedom of speech, all as being possibly important parts of the capabilities concept. Where do we stand with this? The critics say that Sen's notion of capabilities makes some sense, but it's very hard to operationalize. We do have one operationalization, the UN Development Index. It remains to be seen how much more useful we can make Sen's notions of capabilities. But when it comes to how do we judge whether one outcome is better than another, it does seem the idea of capabilities has important advantages over wealth, happiness, or basic needs.
Human well-being and economic well-being is intricately interwoven with planetary well-being. And in Australia, in 2020 or 2021, you only needed to look out the window to see the effects of drought, flood, and bushfire on the well-being of communities, their effects on business, their effect on learning, their effect on people's mental health. But when it comes to policy and service development, the dimensions of well-being are often looked at in isolation. Social projects work on social outcomes, economic projects on economic outcomes, environmental projects on environmental outcomes. I think this is something that New Zealand's well-being approach to policy is trying to shift, but it's rare to have projects with the scope or leverage to work on all aspects of well-being at once. Economist Kate Raworth's model of economics sees achieving optimal well-being as an act of balancing human needs with planetary boundaries, something that can only be achieved if we throw out our ideas of what economics is and replace it with a donut, an idea that's getting real traction around the world, including cities like Amsterdam.
And if you've never studied economics, now's your chance, because I'm going to give you a crash course with a twist. I'm going to show you in 3 minutes what they never tell you in 3 years of a degree. So if you would please open your textbooks to page 23 and study with me the circular flow of goods and money. And as you can see in this diagram, households provide their wage, provide their labor and their capital to firms, and in return they get wages and dividends. And with that income, they spend it on goods and services. And so the resources go round and round, and so does the money. It's simple. And it's important because this diagram is at the heart of macroeconomic analysis, and it's the basis for measuring economic growth. It's so simple that it goes right into the back of the head of every economist so quietly that you don't even realize that it's there. But it's there. And that's a problem, because this diagram is fundamentally flawed. Now, I could add in a financial sector, bringing with it wild speculation and the magical creation of money, and we could watch it wreak havoc in the real economy. We could add in a government sector and talk about taxes and austerity and the damage that you can do. But even without adding in these two sectors, there are four fundamental flaws with this diagram. First, the economy is not floating on a white background. It's deeply embedded in the environment, drawing in matter and energy and spewing out waste and pollution at every juncture. And the fundamental flow is not money going round and round, it's energy coming in from the sun, hitting Earth, fueling life, and some of it bouncing back out into the universe. And it's up to our ingenuity to capture that energy and put it to use. Second, anybody who gets kids up in the morning and off to school knows that not all work is paid. The unpaid caring work of parents raising kids, the next generation of workers, is at the heart of family life, but it's almost completely ignored by mainstream economics. And this woman has a bucket on her head because across sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia, women carry their body weight in water, in fuel, in firewood, with a child on their backs. All for no pay. And if you ignore that, you're ignoring the work of millions of the world's women, which keeps their families alive every day. Third, there's a lot of value that we create that doesn't get monetized. We love to cooperate and collaborate with no money changing hands. If you babysit for me tonight, I'll feed your cat at the weekend. Does that sound trivial? Okay. How about we go online and create the world's biggest encyclopedia ever for free? How about we deliver world-class education to any student in any country for free, online? If you ignore the power of the collaborative commons, you're ignoring one of the most dynamic and disruptive parts of the modern economy. And fourthly, those happy households getting wages and dividends hasn't really turned out like that. As we know, in most high-income countries for some decades now, ordinary households have seen their wages stagnate, while just a tiny few have got high wages and high dividends and rents. In fact, these households are worlds apart, and so too are the firms, with a gulf between local business and global corporations. And hidden behind this flow of income is the accumulation of wealth. And that wealth rapidly turns into power over the economy and who it's run for. Well, that's why I threw away my economics textbooks, and I walked away from economics, and I immersed myself in real-world challenges. I spent 3 years working in the villages of Zanzibar with entrepreneurs who had to earn their living with nothing but their wits, the forest, and their community. I spent 4 years at the United Nations in New York, and I witnessed the barefaced power that would stall global negotiations. And then I became a mother of twins, and I spent a year knee-deep in nappies, immersed in the bare-bum economy of raising infants, and I got gender like never before. And then I worked for Oxfam for a decade, campaigning to tackle climate change, and I met farmers in Southern Africa whose harvests had just turned to bare soil because the rains had never come. And from all of this, I realized the obvious, that you can't walk away from economics, because it's all around us. It's the mentality that our societies are run by. And so I decided to start walking back towards economics, but to flip it on its head. What if economics didn't start with money, but started with human well-being? And there are two sides to that story. On the one hand, our well-being depends on each one of us having the resources we need to meet our human rights, to food, water, health, education, housing, energy. And on the other hand, our well-being also depends on this lady, our planetary home. For the last 12,000 years, the conditions on this planet have been incredibly benevolent to human well-being. We've had a stable climate, plentiful water, clean air, bountiful biodiversity, and a protective ozone layer. And we'd be crazy to put so much pressure on these life support systems that the planet gives us that we actually kick ourselves out of the very sweet spot that we know as home.
So for Raworth, well-being is an act of balancing people's needs whilst working within planetary boundaries.
And I was really struck once I'd drawn this picture to realise that the symbol of well-being in many ancient cultures reflects this very same sense of dynamic balance. From the Maori Takarangi to the Taoist yin-yang, the Buddhist endless knot, the Celtic double spiral. So can we find this dynamic balance in the 21st century?
In this episode, we've been exploring the complexities to consider when thinking about well-being and organising to achieve it. We hear from Clinton Schultz about well-being as a personal value judgment shaped by culture with multiple dimensions. You remember he talked about the importance of surfing and motorbiking to his own well-being alongside his connection to land and culture as an Aboriginal man. Despite the personal aspects of well-being, there are some common elements, even across cultures. And I think we saw this when we compared Clinton's model with the model created by economists Sen, Stiglitz and Fitzhugh. Sherry Kearney, with the Interplay framework, showed us the importance of developing an interplay between different concepts of well-being, with her work translating Aboriginal well-being into things that Australian governments care about. Showing in the process that if you start with what Aboriginal people consider important, you get what government considers important too. Amartya Sen warned us about the risks of measuring subjective well-being alone and introduced us to his view that well-being is determined through the interplay of what you have the opportunity to be, what you can actually do, and what's important to you in life. And we heard from a number of people about balance, the need to balance the needs of people now with the needs of future generations. Positive well-being today doesn't necessarily mean positive well-being will be sustained into the future if the exact things creating well-being in one generation are destroying it for future generations. And the need, as Kate Raworth showed us with a donut, to balance human needs with planetary boundaries. Grant Robinson, New Zealand's finance minister, told us how building a government around well-being fundamentally challenges the status quo. That's because most contemporary ways of measuring success, such as GDP, don't take well-being into account. As Jacinda Ardern said, if you took an economic perspective in 2019 on the budget surplus in New Zealand, it looks good. But when New Zealanders looked around themselves, they saw people sleeping on the streets, and one of the highest rates of youth suicide in the world. And it's this last point that struck me as I put this podcast together, that well-being provides a simple but profound challenge to the status quo. I think the COVID lockdown in Australia was really a very special time because it was perhaps the only time in recent history when we reorganised society around the well-being of the most vulnerable. And that came with some big economic implications, but we did it. And as we transition out of lockdown and into vaccination, there's little real indication from our leaders that well-being is here to stay as a focus. I think it's a very good reminder that the very intention of social innovation is at odds with the dominant economic model, and even how we structure and incentivize or social systems. But perhaps things are beginning to change.